Welcome, Slava. Okay. All right, let me get started. After just stating problems and one theorem last time, I thought I should start to give the ideas that are relevant to the Whitney problems. Let me start with Whitney's idea. Whitney's biggest contribution to the subject is the Whitney extension theorem. And so at the risk of boring many, I'd like to just state it and say a little bit about the proof. This goes back to 1934. I mentioned something about history last time. By the way, what I mentioned about history last time was incomplete, so it was pointed out to me that at very least there was previous work on linear extension operators. Someone named Merian, I think this is the spelling of the name, worked out the one-dimensional case. Okay. And there are other omissions also. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, the classic Whitney extension theorem. All right. So we're as usual, we're fixing positive integers m and n. And we take some completely arbitrary set E in Rn. Well, it might as well be closed. That's not a significant restriction. Doesn't matter whether it's arbitrary or closed. But no assumptions at all. Now, yesterday, the problem was that we're given a function on E, and we want to know whether it extends to a CM function. But now we're given more information. Okay, so for each point x in E, we're given a polynomial, px, in the space, let's say, script p, and these are all, let's say, mth degree polynomials. On Rn. And we ask, does there exist a function f in Cm of Rn such that for each point x in E, the Taylor polynomial of f at the point x is equal to the prescribed guy that was given up here. So does there exist such a thing? How can we tell? Okay? And Whitney gave, 1934, Whitney gave a simple, necessary and sufficient condition. And the quickest way to describe this is the following. Suppose I ask you this question, and I lock you in a room until you come up with as many necessary conditions as possible. after your initial annoyance at being locked in the room, you will quickly come up with a couple of necessary conditions. And Whitney's theorem is that those conditions are also sufficient. Okay. So what are the conditions? Well, so let's see. There should exist a constant m that's going to be a bound for the CM norm. By the way, let me just say, I'm now stating this in not at all in the most efficient possible way, but rather in the way that will tie in best with the next several hours, okay, which will make it look four times as long as it might. All right, so there's some constant m. This is going to be secretly essentially the CM norm of the function capital F, okay? Such that the following holds. Okay, so first necessary condition that you find as you're locked in a closet, suppose you look at px and you take its alpha's derivative and you evaluate it at x. That had better be less than or equal to m for all multi-indices up to order m and all points x and e. Right, because if px is the jet of the unknown function f, at x, and if the derivatives up to order m of the function f are at most capital M, then guess what? This is true. By the way, notice there's a defect in the notation. One could think that this means that that there's a function x goes to p super x of x, and we're differentiating that. No, that's not what this means. What this means is that we think of p super x of y, we differentiate at alpha times in the y variable, we then said y equals x. Whenever I write something like this, that's what I mean, okay? So this is an obvious necessary condition. Then comes Taylor's theorem, and Taylor's theorem tells us two things. It tells us that the thing is, we don't know what F is. So there should exist an M such that a bunch of things happen. Okay? And then the theorem will be these conditions are essentially equivalent to there existing an F, and furthermore the M in here is the CM norm. Okay. The next thing is Taylor's theorem. Suppose you look at Px minus Py for two nearby points, x and y, in the set E. Then this should be less than or equal to m times x minus y to the power m minus alpha. And this is for x, y in E, and let's say for m, for multi-indices of order strictly less than m. And this is simply Taylor's theorem. If a function is in CM and you take two nearby points, then its derivatives of order, you know, its derivatives are at the one point or have to be close to the other. How close? Well, look at Taylor's theorem with remainder. This is what you get. Okay? That's what happens for all xy in E, but if we take the ratio, this ratio tends to zero as x minus y, the distance tends to zero. You know what? Let's take E not merely closed, let's make it compact. Sorry. But otherwise arbitrary. This tends to zero. That's not necessary, but I don't want to fuss with technicalities. When we restrict to x, y in E distinct and alpha less than m. And that's because there's a modulus of continuity in the remainder, in Taylor's theorem with remainder, and we don't know what that modulus of continuity is, but it definitely tends to zero as the distance tends to zero. So this is what you get for any points, and this is what you get as the distance tends to zero. Okay, so these are the obvious necessary conditions, and then Whitney's theorem says. So the Whitney extension theorem. Well, strictly less. Less than or equal to. You're right. Less than or equal to. Thank you. You're right. Thank you. Okay. So the Whitney extension theorem says that there exists M such that A, B, and C hold, that that's exactly equivalent to there exists an F in CM such that the jet of F agrees with the given P for all X in E. And moreover, if A, B, C hold, then the optimal M in ABC is comparable, or has the same order of magnitude. As the inf of the CM norms of overall F that do the job. Okay? That is, so same order of magnitude, that means that the inf of all M that do the job times some little constant is less than or equal to the inf of the CM norm of F over all F that do the job, and that's less than or equal to a big constant times the inf of all M that do the job. And these two constants depend only on little m and little n. So they depend only on which function space we're working in. Okay, just a quick show of hands. How many people know this theorem and its proof? Well,
present.
I'm sorry? Present. Okay. So thank you for giving me the feeling. Thank you for, you know, there's one of many wonderful New Yorker cartoons is a professor giving a lecture, and everyone from everyone in the audience rises a thought bubble, why am I here? And from the professor rises the thought bubble, why am I here? So what can I tell you? Education is perverse and often baffling. But in any event, all right. So there is some point in my saying this. Okay. Now, all right. Fine. So moreover, not only is this true, but the proof of Whitney's theorem exhibits a capital F. And not only that, but the capital F depends linearly on the data being the P super X's. Okay? And not only that, but the linear dependence is of a very simple type. It is sparse. So what I'd like to do is spend now a little bit of time discussing what this is going to do for us. Remember our problem, this is very nice, but it is not the problem that we posed before. And in particular, for finite E, it's not the problem that we would love to solve for applications. What we're given is not a jet at every point, but a function value at every point of some set E of data points. And so what does this do for us? I'd like to explain quickly what this does for us. Then I'd like to explain the main idea in the proof of the Whitney extension theorem. To give a complete proof is to slog through unpleasant details, and I think nobody in the room wants that. But the fundamental idea behind the proof is simple and beautiful and important. So I'd like to explain it. And then we will pass to the next topic. Okay. So let me think. We're 10:30 to 12. When the right time to take a break is half an hour from now. Is that right? Okay. All right. So what does this do for us? Well, first of all, let's suppose that the set E is finite. Okay, if the set E is finite, then this condition C doesn't mean anything, right? The distance between, you know, here we're looking at two different points, two distinct points in a finite set, and we want to take the limit as the distance between them goes to zero. That never happens. So this condition is vacuously satisfied for E finite. And so we just have these two. Suppose, for instance, that I give you a finite set E, and I give you a function, so E is now finite, and I give you a real valued function here, and I ask, is there a CM function that agrees with F? Well, we don't know, but whatever this CM function is, it has some jet or other at each point x of the set E. Okay? And so we could instead of thinking of F as given, we could think of the whole jet as being given. In that case, we can solve the problem by Whitney's extension theorem, and so we ask ourselves that d alpha px of x is less than or equal to m for all alpha less than or equal to m and x in E, and we demand that d alpha of px minus py at x is less than or equal to m x minus y to the m minus alpha for x, y in E, and alpha less than m. Okay? So we could demand that. But what does that have to do with our original problem? Well, we should make sure that px of x is f of x for all x in E. Consider these conditions. Okay? Now I claim what we're trying to do is to solve these conditions with m as small as possible. Okay? And I claim that the smallest possible m is essentially has in terms of order of magnitude. Now I'm never looking at the particular at the exact CM norm. I'm always looking at the order of magnitude. I'm looking at things up to constants like that. But I claim the best possible M, the smallest M for which we can make all these things work, is the least possible norm of a CM function that agrees with the data being this guy. And furthermore, the way to make the extension is the following. First, solve this problem, find m as small as possible, and find out what the px's are that cause all these inequalities to happen with m as small as possible. Then take those px's and to them apply the proof of the Whitney extension theorem, which is constructive. Okay? And then we will have a function f whose CM norm is essentially m, and whose jet at each point x is equal to this, and in particular whose function value at each point is the right thing. Is that clear? Should I explain more or just... Okay. Please, nobody feel intimidated, okay? If you don't understand, say that you don't understand. You can feel... I'd rather you not feel bored, but I would consider it a disaster if anybody is snowed. Okay. So we have to solve this. Now notice this is a linear algebra. This is a linear programming problem, except for the fact that there are absolute values here. These are linear inequalities, and to spell out everything, no matter how trivial, to say that the absolute value of this is less than or equal to m, that means plus this is less than or equal to m, and also minus this is less than or equal to m. Wow, and so there is a list of linear inequalities. And what we are trying to do is to satisfy the linear inequalities with one particular number, namely m, being as small as possible. Okay? This is a classic linear programming problem. The unknowns are the px's for each x in the finite set E, so that's we're in a finite dimensional vector space. All right, so the finite dimensional vector space consists of all these guys together with the number m. That's a point in our vector space, and here we're solving a linear algebra problem, linear programming problem. Okay, now, that's what happens for a general set E. So linear programming is pretty bad in the worst case, but a polynomial time in a typical case. Is this a typical case or a worst case? I don't know. But we're going to do much better than this anyway. This is what one can say about the practical problem based on math as of 1934. Okay, so we're going to do a lot better than this. Okay. On the other hand, let me ask a different question. Suppose that E is not merely finite, but small. suppose that I give you some absolute upper bound on the number of points of E. That doesn't completely trivialize the problem because, for instance, suppose there are only 11 points. E has only 11 points. But two of these points are very close together, and two other points are very close together. And maybe this pair of nearby points is close to this pair of nearby points, but that distance is large compared to either of these distances, and but that distance in turn is small compared, you know, it's not exactly clear where these points sit. So this is not a completely trivial problem. But if you suppose there are at most 11 points, look at all these problems and remember, we don't care exactly what is the best M, we only care about its order of magnitude. And so instead, we could make a quadratic form. We could sum d alpha px of x squared over x in E alpha less than or equal to m, and then we could sum over x, y in E of, and then alpha strictly less than m, and then we could take d alpha of px minus py at x squared over x minus y to the m minus alpha squared. Okay? And this quadratic form has in it, well, so for this quadratic form to be less than or equal to m squared is morally equivalent to all of these inequalities. Well, all of these inequalities holding. Okay? Well, certainly, if this holds, each one of these terms individually is less than or equal to m squared, and so each one of these guys holds. Each one of these guys holds. And conversely, if each one of these guys holds and the set E has at most 11 points in it, then by looking at these inequalities and squaring them and adding, you get this, but with m squared replaced by a constant times m squared, that constant depending only on little m and little n. Again, we're working in cm of Rn, so that's little m and little n. And also depending on the number 11, the number of points in the set E. Okay? So what we actually, what we could do is we could minimize this guy subject to the constraint that px of x equals f of x are given f of x for each x in E. So these are linear constraints. This is a quadratic form. We are, an affine constraint. This is, okay, we are minimizing a given quadratic form on an affine subspace of finite dimensional vector space. So therefore, if E is finite, we've reduced matters to a linear programming problem. If I have a bound on, if E is not merely finite, but if I have a bound on the number of points of E, this problem is reduced to linear algebra. Okay, and so then I can actually produce a solution. It's constructive, it's easy, it's linear. Okay, so little problems are easy. That's the take-home message, and that follows from Whitney's extension theorem. Okay, let me see. What have I not done? Well, I have not said anything about the. Okay, yes. Okay, I've not said anything about the proof. Let me explain the idea in the proof. It's very beautiful. So here's the terrible set E. For each point x in E, we're given not merely a function value, but a jet. right? But we would like to produce a function capital F that lives on the whole Rn. Let's take an enormous cube that contains the set E. This is not to scale. The cube is enormous. There it is. If we can produce the function on that cube, it's trivial to extend to the rest of the world. Okay? So we would like to define a function capital F on the enormous cube. Well, we look at the enormous cube and we see that it's too big. And so it is wrong. We don't like it. So we subdivide it. That means we partition it into subcubes half as big as itself in the obvious way. So here I've drawn the two-dimensional version of what I'm going to call bisecting a cube. Okay, so we bisect the cube. And now we look at each of these cubes in turn, and we ask, do we like them? And the answer is no, we don't. And so we bisect them. And at each stage, let's say at this point, we like this cube. I have to explain, of course, what it means to say that we like a cube. But as soon as I tell you what it means that we like a cube, well, I owe you that. That's, of course, crucial. We like this cube, and so we stop bisecting it. We keep it. We put it aside over there. Okay? But now we don't like this cube, and so we bisect it. We put aside all the cubes that we like, and we bisect all the cubes that we don't like and look at them. All right? And, let's say we like none of these, and so we bisect them again. And let's say we like this one. And so we take it and put it aside. But we don't like this one, so we bisect it again, and so on. And we keep doing this forever. Now, I have to tell you what it means that we like a cube or we don't like a cube. The rule is very simple. The rule is, given any cube, let me redraw the picture. Here's a set E, and here's a cube Q, which we may or may not like. Let's take this cube and dilate it by a factor of 2 or 3, and let's call that the cube Q star. So given a cube Q, Q star is the cube which has the same center as Q, but let's say 3 times the diameter. Okay? And I'm going to say that we like the cube Q if Q star contains no points of the set E. That's my rule for whether we like the cube Q or not. Okay? And so with that rule, we start with an enormous cube with E somewhere in the middle, and we keep bisecting and saving the cubes we like and bisecting the cubes we don't like, and we go on forever. Okay? That's Whitney's construction. Now, what does that do? Well, the claim is that here yet again is the set E, and if you look at the cubes that we keep, I claim they form a partition of the complement of E into pairwise disjoint cubes, and furthermore these cubes have the property that for each one of these cubes, the diameter of the cube is comparable to the distance of the cube to the set E. Let's take that slowly. Why is it that these things are pairwise disjoint? Well, that's clear from the construction without worrying about what it means for us to like a cube, right? The situation is, here's a cube. We like it, so we set it aside. We never bisect it. We only bisect other fellows. There's no possibility of ever obtaining anything that intersects that guy. So the cubes are, am I right? That's obvious. The cubes are pairwise disjoint. Now, the cubes form a partition of E, so I have to show you that given any point not in E, it is contained in a cube. Well, so let's follow this complicated-looking construction, but let's fix one particular point. Let's call it the point Y. Let's fix one point Y that does not belong to E, and let's just keep track of, as we go through this construction, let's keep track of the cubes that contain Y. Well, to begin with, we have the whole big cube that contains Y. Then we have we decide to bisect it, so there's this next smaller fellow that contains Y. Then we bisect, perhaps we bisect that. At each stage of the construction, if we bisect, we get in dimension n, 2 to the n little subcubes, and one of those contains the point Y, exactly one. And so therefore, what you're looking at is a biggest cube, another cube half as big, another cube half as big as that, and so on, and they all contain Y. And so in the limit, they shrink down to the point Y. After enough steps, I mean, this process may stop. We may like a given cube that contains Y, in which case I'm done. I've proven that one of these cubes contains the point Y. Okay? But perhaps the construction goes on forever and I'm never satisfied. Well, wait a minute. At some point, these cubes are tiny. Remember, E is a closed set and Y is not in E, and so a sufficiently tiny cube containing Y will have the property that Q star does not meet E, and then we will declare that we are happy, and so then we will set aside the cube at that stage. So at some stage we have to be happy, and therefore these cubes fill out all of E. Furthermore, for any one of these cubes, I claim the distance from this cube is comparable to its diameter. And that's because of a very, very simple and important consequence of this general method of picking a decomposition into cubes, which is the following. Take any cube that we end up with. We are happy with it, but we are not happy with the next bigger cube that contains it. It arose by subdividing some cube twice as big as itself with which we were not happy. Okay? Now let's think what that means. Let's see, how many times can I draw the same picture? I guess there's no limit. Okay? So let's say, here's a cube Q in our Whitney decomposition. So these are called Whitney cubes. Okay? Now, we were happy with this cube, and therefore, when we form the cube Q star, by definition, it does not contain any points of the set E. So the distance from E to this cube is at least the side length of the cube. On the other hand, I'd like to show you that the distance from E to the cube is at most some constant times the side length, and the reason is that this fellow, which we like, this Whitney cube, arose by bisecting the fellow twice as big, like that, and we did not like this cube. Therefore, when we formed Q star, for Q being this parent cube, so here's its Q star, we were not happy with this guy, and therefore this fellow must contain some point of E. And therefore, the distance from here to E is less than or equal to some constant multiple of the diameter of E. Okay? And so we have E, we have the complement of E decomposed into a lot of cubes. And each cube, so these are pairwise disjoint, they fill up the complement, and the size of each cube is comparable to its distance to E. Okay, now that's all very nice, and in fact these are very significant for geometry. They're sort of the n-dimensional substitute of the component intervals of an open set in R1. Okay, but now, all right, our immediate problem is to build a function capital F. So let's do the following. For each Whitney cube, I'm going to build a candidate for what F is on that Whitney cube. Then, let's see, they will sort of but not perfectly agree on the boundaries of the cubes, and so we're going to have to fuss a little to correct them and make them agree sufficiently well. So, all right. So for each Whitney cube Q, let's look at, I'm going to define a function FQ, which is our first guess at what the extension F is going to be over there. And it's very simple, because for each cube Q, we know that the distance to the set E is comparable to the diameter of Q. So let's pick a point XQ in E, whose distance from Q is comparable to the diameter of Q. It could be the closest point. Maybe there's more than one closest point. It doesn't have to be the closest. It's the closest within a factor of 10. Okay? That's XQ. Now, all right. Remember, associated with this point is a jet, PXQ. This is a polynomial with which any extension had better agree very well. Let's just guess that our FQ is equal to that polynomial associated to the point XQ. And so that's going to be our definition, not just on Q, but on a slightly bigger fellow, not Q star, which was Q expanded by a factor of 3, but let's say Q tilde, which is Q expanded by a factor of 2. Okay? Not as big as Q star, but bigger than Q. And so FQ is defined on Q tilde. And it's simply that. Notice that so far, if I want to differentiate it, let me perhaps shut up. this enormous cube, by the way, let's take this enormous cube to be a unit cube. And if we can do this problem on the unit cube, we patch together. I don't actually want to think about polynomials on truly enormous cubes, because they will, for example, they will be big, and I don't want my extension function to be big. But never mind. Don't worry about such technical details as that I've done it wrong. Just the idea is the important thing. I think Tom Lehrer said that. Okay. So okay. So there's each of these FQ. Now, unfortunately, if I take two different cubes, I've given two conflicting definitions. So therefore, I'm going to make a partition of unity. By the way, something I didn't say before about the Whitney cubes Q. Obviously, no Whitney cube contains any points of E, because we're happy with each Whitney cube. So, okay, I forgot to say that. All right, so I'm going to make a partition of unity. One is the sum on all Whitney cubes of a function theta q. And theta q is a function which is, supported in q tilde and is as smooth as possible given that it's supported in q tilde. So the support of theta q is contained in q tilde. And if I differentiate theta q, that's less than some constant times the diameter of Q to the power minus alpha. Those are the natural estimates for functions that go from zero outside here to something about as big as one in here. Okay. It's easy to construct this the same way one usually constructs partitions of unity. Okay. You take first, don't worry about these theta Q summing to zero. Just take for each Q, take theta Q to be one in here and zero out here, and as smooth as possible. And you can do that by making a construction for the unit cube and then translating and dilating it. So it's that produces this and this, but unfortunately these guys don't sum to one. So therefore you take each one, you see what this sum is, and you divide by that sum. And that's it. So this is called the Whitney partition of unity. Okay. And now, once you have the Whitney cubes and the F sub Q and the Whitney partition of unity, the Whitney partition of unity can be used to um, Whitney partition of unity can be used to combine these F sub Q. So you define F to be the sum on Q of theta Q F sub Q outside E. And you define F of X to be the given jet PX evaluated at the point X if X is in E. Then we have to check that it works. That's the messy part. I will skip the messy part. Okay? So this is the proof of Whitney's extension theorem. Now, why do I say that it's so important? One reason why it's so important is the following. It's based on the idea of starting with a fixed cube, maybe an enormous one, maybe a unit cube, but start with a fixed cube and then keep subdividing it until we're happy. Okay? That idea is one of the big ideas in analysis. It appeared in the 50s as the Calderon-Zygmund decomposition, and I don't know, I make a living on it. Maybe that biases me toward it. It's a very important idea. Nobody says that Whitney's criterion for happiness is the only one. More generally, you can make up your own criterion for happiness depending on the problem you're solving, and you can bisect until you're happy. And I'm going to call that a Calderon-Zygmund decomposition. there are lots of them, and we will be seeing lots of them. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the Whitney extension theorem. So let's take a short break. Maybe let's say when that clock says 20 after, I'll start again. Okay, is that a reasonable break, or should I make a little bit longer break when that clock says 25 after? When that clock says 20 after, I'll start again, and it'll be on a completely different subject.